This is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast with a new episode available each week at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, your podcast app of choice, or even our apps. My name is Aaron Peterson. I'm going to be your host for this special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. As our loyal listeners know, every once in a while, we like to bring you interviews with independent filmmakers to give you an insight into both what goes into getting their films made, as well as insight into the respective film itself. First episode, we are talking to Cardinal X director Angie Wong. Now, Cardinal X is loosely based on Angie Wong's life in the early 80s. Annie Q stars as Angie, who's a young woman who is accepted into a prestigious college and then realizes she cannot afford it. She comes from the wrong side of the track. She's not wealthy, unlike her roommate, played by Francesca Eastwood. So what she does is she finds a way to create and manufacture ecstasy and sells it and ends up becoming extremely successful before a series of events take her on a downward spiral. The film is not your typical drug exploitation. It's not really focused on any violence or anything like that. It's focused on the character of Angie and what she went through this time period in the early 80s. It's a really engaging film. It's a really interesting character study. I hope you guys definitely check it out. It's now in festivals and it should be releasing throughout the year. It's called Cardinal X. You can always find them on Twitter and Instagram at Cardinal X Movie. They're also on Facebook. Look them up. It's at Cardinal X Movie. And right now we're going to talk to the director, Angie Wong. She's an extremely interesting woman to talk to. She's had an exciting life. And seeing as this is her story, there's nobody else better suited to tell it. So without further ado, without any more of my rambling, let's get into my exclusive interview with director, writer, and bassist for Cardinal X, Angie Wong.
Aaron, it's Angie Wong calling. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, you know, I think I just misdialed because I got a Lupe Gonzalez, so.
Oh, I am okay. So not a Lupe Gonzalez, no. Is it pronounced Wong?
Yeah, it's pronounced Wong.
Okay, well, I don't want to say it
even though it's spelled Wang.
Anglo-Saxon, I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, I thank Charles Wong for perpetuating the mispronunciation of our fine family name. I credit him with it.
Well, then let's start off with this. The first thing I ask anybody who comes by is, what prompted you to want to be a filmmaker? I know that I read that you and your father bonded over movies. Was that when it struck you, or was there a moment?
You know, I didn't really think that it was like a possibility for me as a kid growing up. You know, I always loved film and TV, but it never really dawned on me that I could move into that world and tell my own stories. You know, I was always kind of a writer. And I liked, you know, and I journal and I wrote my little short stories and that type of thing. But, you know, for me, foremost, I was like, I need to make money. You know, so I sold software, which was not hard. It was creative in a different sense. I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it was a really kind of a winding path for me to get to filmmaking and sort of realize that, wow, I have a bunch of stories that I want to tell. And I think that media is this really beautiful and powerful way to be able to shape hearts and minds. So, you know, after, you know, a really lucky career in Silicon Valley, I found myself in this really sort of enviable situation where I was like, I don't need to sling hash anymore for a living if I don't want to. So, you know, I founded a nonprofit and basically got to reach out to my own, you know, damaged inner middle school kid and worked with them to sort of, you know, allow them, give them a venue to be able to really talk about a lot of the issues and the obstacles that were going on in their lives. And I was like, wow, these are some really powerful stories. And I feel like, you know, we're at a really critical point in our society where we need to really, really, you know, hook into our empathy. Because I think we're so divided, you know, the world is full of hatred. I mean, sometimes I have to like turn off the news because it just overwhelms me a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I think I'm going to make a movie. My friends are like, you're kind of batshit crazy. Like, you don't know how to fucking make a movie. Like, you've never done this before. And I just sort of, I took a little class and I took a screenwriting class. And I think each step of the way, you know, I thought, oh, I'll get someone else to do this for me. And then I thought, I'm just going to do it myself. So, you know, when I initially pitched the screenplay around, to my delight and surprise, people were pretty responsive and they were like, this is a good story, but we'd like to make the lead a white girl.
Oh,
like,
no.
See Miley Cyrus play her. And I was like, no. Being an Asian American is very integral to her story. They kind of weren't hearing it. So I thought, well, I know how to raise money. I come from the Valley. So I raised my own money and kind of put it together.
Did they really try to do that? I mean, it's your own story and they wanted to change it to a white girl.
They did. And Miley Cyrus was brought up to me a couple of times. I guess they were looking for a vehicle for her at that point.
Gotcha.
And I think, you know, she's a talented girl, but I was like, it's not her story. Right. It is absolutely not her story.
That's really sad.
Yeah, I found that I really had to sort of stick to my guns and not be afraid just to hold my ground and kind of kick the door down a little. That was
great.
A long-winded way to not really answer your question, I'm afraid.
It did. To a degree.
Okay.
A lot of people, I think, come into filmmaking and they either – I wanted to be Spielberg when I was 6 years old. And I made movies around the house. Or I stumbled onto it, or I found I could make money with it. You know, there's a lot of different answers to it, which is why it's always interesting to hear how people get into it. Yours is a much longer story. I mean, it's a lot more detailed because you went through a lot of steps to even get to this point.
I did. And I'm old, so yeah, I'm not some fresh-faced 25-year-old, you know. When I took that one class, I was sitting there, and I'm like, I'm not trying to be like a young D girl, you know, like I'm not a D girl. I'm, you know, at that point, I was like a 47-year-old woman, and I'm like, I don't have all that time. I have to sort of shortcut it.
Let's talk about your journey, because Cardinal X has been, I assume, a pretty long journey for you. Can you talk about what it finally took? I mean, aside from the Miley Cyrus angle, to actually get it made.
Yeah, you know, it's like having a baby, and I feel like, you know, it's funny. I had a 10-pound, 2-ounce baby, and she was a very painful, long process. And I had written this very detailed birth plan, and nothing held in the birth plan. But I had a healthy kid at the end, which is really what you're striving for.
Right.
But nothing happened the way I thought it would. Nothing happened the way I planned it. You know, and it sort of was that way with the movie. My friends are like, yeah, you really like to have big babies. This is sort of a big film for your first film. Like, why don't you just do a short? And I thought, because I want to do a full-length narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think I can. So, you know, a lot of it, I raised the money fairly quickly. I was really lucky in that. And I got Rick Bosner involved, who, you know, was the producer for Fruitvale Station. And he, you know, it's funny because the way I kind of stumbled across him was I had another guy who was a line producer, and, you know, he was based in L.A., and I was like, he didn't really understand, you know, the San Francisco market in terms of shooting there. Mm-hmm. And didn't have access to crew and the like. And, you know, he was really used to working with a lot more money than what I had. He had mentioned Fruitvale Station as a movie that had been shot up there, so I just kind of was tinkering around on IMDb, found Rick Bosner, and, you know, he has his contact information on IMDb Pro, so I just reached out to him directly, not knowing if the guy's going to, like, you know, ping me back at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
To my delight, like 20 minutes later, he pinged me back. We were on the phone like an hour later, and then that was like a Saturday, and by that Tuesday, he was at my house, and we were shaking hands, and we were like, let's make this fucking movie. And then, you know, we set about kind of casting it, and, you know, he had crew, you know, this fantastic crew already sort of in place in San Francisco.
Yeah.
A lot of people in San Francisco shoot commercials to stay alive, but everyone really loves to do a narrative. So, you know, he reached out to all of his contacts. And then I realized during the casting process that I was like, man, it's going to be hard for me to stand out because everyone just assumes that I'm a first-time director who doesn't know what the hell she's doing. And in some ways that was true. But I was like, I need like a legitimizing agent. So I stalked Cassian Elwes into being my executive producer.
Ooh.
You know, I'd seen him speak at the American Film Market, and I was like, you're going to be my exec. So I literally would, like, show up places and be like, hi, Cassian, I'm Angie Wong.
And that
I,
works.
I got a meeting with him, and he was like, all right, you know, it's a pretty good story. All right, let's do it. Then, you know, the casting process was a pretty arduous one. You know, it was really, really challenging for me to find the lead. And ironically, Annie Q, who, you know, I couldn't imagine anyone else playing the role at this point. She was the first person I ever read. And at first I passed. At first I was like, I just wasn't sure because to me she was just so tiny and vulnerable. And I never imagined myself as that young. But when I looked back at pictures, I was like, oh yeah, you were young. You were like 18 years old. And you know, I looked across the dinner table one evening at my then stepdaughter and my daughter, who were teenagers, and I was like, oh man, this character is really more their peer than what I have sort of concocted in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, it was an easy decision to cast Annie at that point. And then shooting it was a breeze. It was the biggest party, the most fun. I was like, oh, we're not going to push one day. And they were like, you're crazy. You're a first-time director. You will push. No, but we did not push one day, and we actually brought it in under budget, but then I blew it out in post anyhow. So, each leg of the journey has been quite a learning process. And then, you know, we had a hard time. We struggled getting it seen. You know, I think that, and that happens to a lot of filmmakers I found.
Mm-hmm.
We really, it took us a while to find our home at Campfest, and it was a spectacular premiere for us. You know, it was like a great coming home and, you know, had a wonderful time. But, you know, it took a while and it was pretty frustrating. I mean, there were days and I was like, why the fuck am I doing this? Like, it's just, I feel like I'm self-flagellating constantly. But keep your eye on the prize, which is really, you know, you want your work to be seen. You hope that it will connect with people. You know, you hope that it'll inspire something in someone else. So, you know, at this point, it doesn't just belong to me. It belongs to, well, of course, everyone who worked on it, everyone who touched it, but also the people who've seen it, who can relate to it, who it inspires maybe some empathy in or, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. And one thing I learned, this is semi-autobiographical.
Yes.
But I don't know the statute of limitations on this question, so if you can't answer, don't. Did you actually teach yourself how to make ecstasy?
Well, I wasn't quite as clever as I portray myself in the movie. I had a sidekick who did a lot of the work, who just wanted no part of this story being told.
Gotcha.
So, you know, to protect them, I made myself a genius. You know, I did some of the work. I probably did like maybe 30 to 40% of it.
That's still, that's a good chunk back in the 80s, especially.
Yeah, and there was no internet. My friends are like, do you think you could do it now? And I'm like, you'd be on a DEA watch list in a heartbeat if you ordered any of those ingredients at this point. And no, I'm not about to manufacture ecstasy again, so forget it.
Yeah, that's not, I think you're doing all right. You should probably stick with this. This works.
Yeah. I'll just make movies about it.
Exactly. Annie Q, you talked about, portrays Angie as a damaged but determined woman, who I assume is how you felt at the time. But she creates this mini empire with hardly any help. And as much as she's breaking the law, I got to tell you, by the end of the movie, I really kind of admired her. How was it for you to direct someone to essentially portray yourself?
Oh, well, it was sort of a dream with Annie. You know, she actually stayed with me at my home for like, you know, the month of pre-production, and just sort of really wanted to kind of shadow me and ask me questions and get to know me. So, you know, that was a real privilege and a pleasure. And then, you know, really what I had to do is, you know, I'm definitely, they've told me this over and over again. They're like, you're like an actor's director, and that I, you know, I'm not going to be like, hey, squint your face up like this, and, you know, you need to cry on this beat. For me, it was really more about giving them all the backstory and all the tools and making a safe place for them to really kind of like explore the dark. You know, there were a lot of sort of, you know, pretty emotional, intense moments in the film. And I think I just really strove to give them all the tools that they needed, and, you know, they went for it. So, I mean, I think what we got on the screen is not really me. It's, you know, it's my experience, my words, but filtered through Annie Q's reality, you know, and then blown up on the screen. So, you know, it's a piece of all of us, but it was a pleasure to direct her. And, you know, we got to know each other really well, and I knew how to push her. I knew what she needed. I knew when she needed quiet. I knew when people, you know, needed to like not talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
So, we got to know each other pretty well.
It was great because I grew up in the 80s, and
yes.
Yeah. So a lot of it really rings true. And I want to talk about the soundtrack soon, but I want to hit some other points first. Angie faces numerous obstacles in her life throughout the movie. Her mother leaves her at an early age, a strange relationship with her father, and a sexual assault. Was it important for you to not skimp on any harsh realities, to not movie code it, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I screened it for my cousins, and they were like, man, that was like kind of rough for us to watch. You know, it's kind of like getting a peek into your journal. And I really felt, so going back to my nonprofit work, you know, we basically did like a process group. And what I found was, when I told my own story, then it sort of gave permission to these kids to sort of explore their own demons. And I wanted to do that on screen. And I thought, you know, if I skimp on this, if I try to sugarcoat it and make myself try to look better than I actually was, or not tell the truth with regard to a lot of the sexual trauma, then I'm not doing the story justice. You know, I'm really not doing the story justice. So I was sitting there filming the rape scene under the tunnel. It was like, it'd been a long day of shooting. It was like, you know, I think 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like dining on, you know, stale Cheetos and slugging back canned espresso. My friends are like, it's so glamorous what you're doing. I'm like, it's really not. I'm sitting in like this dusty tunnel. It smells like urine, and I'm filming, you know, portrayal of my 30-year-old rape. I'm like, it's not really living the dream. It's not red carpet.
Was that the hardest moment for you to film? Or were there actually more difficult? Like, I could see the father-daughter aspects to be difficult as well.
You know, the only time that I cried on set was when Rodrigo Cabral, who became my production designer and who's become like a brother to me, he built me this set that really rang true. I mean, he built me a set that when I walked in, I felt like I walked into a time capsule, and I felt like I was walking into my childhood home. And I just was like, oh my God, I kind of lost it. So those scenes with Ron, who was also like a brother to me now, who plays Michael, my father, mm-hmm. were very poignant, very emotional. You know, the scene when he's like flipping out with the knife and then, you know, the dialogue between him and Angie at the end. So that story actually is a deadlift from my childhood. That really happened to my father, and he really delivered it to me in almost that fashion.
Oh, wow.
So it's a story that I've lived with since I was like 7, 8 years old.
That's tough.
So that to see that come to life and to be delivered so beautifully with such passion and such grace was very powerful, really powerful for me.
It was powerful. And speaking of powerful performances, I actually, 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I just interviewed the director of MFA.
Oh, MFA. Yes. Yeah.
Francesca Eastwood's other performance. So, I mean, it's like two really solid. It really feels like she is an up-and-comer as well. I think Annie
She's
is as well.
She's so talented. She can do anything. She's super funny, too, which I'd love to work on a project with her to really reflect her comedic talent, because she's fucking hilarious. She had me howling. Like, sometimes I couldn't even look at her because I'd just start laughing. But, yeah, she's wildly talented. I'm excited to see her in MFA.
What was it about her that really sold you on her for the role? Because her, Annie and Franny, basically, yeah. I wouldn't call them a couple. They're just more of kindred spirits.
They're a duo. Yeah, they're a duo. I really wanted them to build that chemistry beforehand because I call bullshit on that kind of stuff on the screen all the time. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted them to get together. So we all had a meeting and we all sat down together. And I was like, you guys should go to eat dinner, get drunk together, take a road trip, you know, really get to know each other. And then they were housed in the same place. So, you know, the chemistry that you see on screen is very real. Franny has a really sort of larger than life persona. Like, she walks into the room and you're like, oh, she's a movie star. She works so hard for the role. So my initial conversation with her was over Skype. And it's funny because her mom, Frances Fisher, was in like scurrying around in the background in a nightgown. And it's ironic because I've since become quite friendly with Frances. She's a lovely woman and a wonderful actress as well.
But
Franny, I don't know if it's just in her genes or she has this bigger than life kind of quality to her that it's sort of indefinable, you know? And the first time I saw her on my screen, I was like, wow, you know, she's really got a presence. And like I said, she works so hard to get to the role, to get to the meat of it. So, you know, it was her willingness. It was her, you know, I was a little dazzled by her star quality, actually. She's just got a really powerful charisma, I think, and it comes across on screen.
Yeah, and they're a great team. I mean,
they play off each other very well. I love the chemistry between those two girls.
Now, going into some of your personal experiences, I really appreciated you taking us into the Asian American home. I don't think that's really done on film or represented very often, as well as black neighborhoods. I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood myself. So mm-hmm. those things, a lot of times they're portrayed by people that have never even been in a black neighborhood or an Asian neighborhood.
Makes me crazy. But it makes me crazy.
You can't explain it to people because you tell, well, what do you know? You're white or whatever. You know what? I live there. So you see it. You know what Hollywood put up there is not what it looks like.
Yeah.
And you really captured that. So thanks for bringing that to film. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you for that. I remember I kept telling Rodrigo, I'm like, just make it tacky. Make the Chinese home super tacky. Like a lot of knickknacks and shit. And I need plastic on the chair. So he nailed it. Yeah, he nailed it. You know, I love those scenes. I love the dinner, the Christmas dinner scene. You know, it's like her one shot at being normal at that point.
Was that a real story as well? I mean, was that taken directly from your life, or was that?
Yeah. So the real Tommy. We're very close friends, and his mother is a super good cook, and we really did have dinners like that. So yes.
That's great.
It felt very familiar.
Well, with everything so personal in the movie, was the soundtrack predominantly selected because of the 80s time period, or were they all specific songs to you personally? Because it has a very 80s vibe, a very eclectic soundtrack.
They were all songs that I loved.
Okay.
They're all songs that I loved. And then Ron Yuan has directed MC Light in a couple of music videos, and he said, you know, I think Light can give you some music, because we were like way out of money. Light came and sat down and screened the movie with me and was like, I'm going to give you these songs that sound very 80s and, you know, take what you want. So she's this lovely, generous, really smart, savvy businesswoman. Mm-hmm. And Moby donated some music too. So I got super lucky. But yeah, the songs that I picked, like, the Cars song and Kajagoogoo, they were all songs that I loved back in the 80s.
That's great. Before we go, can you talk a little bit about your work with GROW?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Tell me more about, and that's Global Resiliency Outreach Work, correct?
Yes, okay. Correct. So I targeted middle schoolers because I feel like that's a really critical point. And it's usually, if you're going to, like, you know, start doing drugs or, you know, start going out and having a lot of sex, you usually will do it around middle school. So I figured it's sort of the last bastion. Because once they get to high school, it's harder to turn them.
Mm-hmm.
Not turn them, but to, you know, to sort of guide them. And basically what we do is we do like a process group, you know, like you might experience in you know, like a rehab or other therapeutic venues. And, you know, we just sort of allow them to kind of give and receive support. And I think, you know, we don't really explicitly give kids the tools, you know, to build their resilience, you know. So I think, you know, we try to do that with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great jumping off point because you get to really know these kids, you know, what's going on in their homes, you know, what's going on in their heads and hearts. And so it's a good jumping off point in terms of getting them other services that they might need, like one-on-one counseling or, you know, she's really smart but she's dyslexic. And so we need to get her, you know, a tutor or, you know, help guide them along the whole process of, you know, getting into a college. And then what I've learned is, you know, I think a lot of people are like, hey, we've run the race when they get to college. I'm like, no, it's just the beginning of a whole new race. And the attrition rate is super high for kids like that because they don't really know how to go about, you know, tapping into resources to assist them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's sort of my next step with this work is I'd like to put together a little posse to be able to support kids on campus. So I'm not sure what that looks like yet, but I'm going to turn my attention to it pretty quick.
That's great. That's
thank
great.
You. Thank you. The Real Bree, actually, well, the Real Bree is the amalgamation of like maybe four or five kids, but one of the kids, Daryl, just graduated from Oberlin recently and actually came to the San Francisco screening and is going to be coming down for the LA screening. So I'm super proud of him. He's a great kid. And, you know, definitely sort of, you know, the poster child for resilience.
Does that, I mean, when you take all those factors into account, does that make you feel like, you know what, that journey was absolutely worth it because of where everything has ended up for you, both with the movie and with GROW and your personal life?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, I mean, I've been very blessed in a lot of ways and I've certainly had my challenges, but I think, you know, you really do learn through crisis, you know, and you sort of get legs under you. And, you know, I told somebody the other day, I was like, you know I can go out and make money because I've done it before. Like I have that confidence. I have that knowledge that I'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can buy that. And I don't think it can be given to you. I think it's just something that you have to earn. I mean, I'm fucked up in a million different ways too, but you know, at the end of the day, you just keep trying to like make the right decision, you know, each little decision.
So what's next for you? Do you have a project?
I'm gonna make more movies. Yeah. I've got a couple of things that I'm working on and, you know, I think, you know, the time is ripe now for this type of storytelling. I'd love to do some TV. You know, I'd love to have all that real estate to be able to really develop character and tell story. And I feel like, you know, for me, week after week, watching characters, you learn a lot about yourself through watching their journey. So, you know, I'd love to be able to do some television soon. But yeah, I fall in love with this mode of storytelling. So it's like my dope now.
well played. Well, I know I got to let you go, but I just want to say thanks for coming by. Best of luck with the film. It's doing festivals now and it'll be releasing soon.
Yeah, right? Yeah. We're playing in LA on April 30th and then we have an encore May 3rd. And then we're off to New York to play the New York City Independent Film Festival on the 7th, which is a Sunday. Yeah. It was so much fun talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. I better let you go.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Have
a great day. Bye.
There you go, guys. That was my interview with writer and director and bassist for Cardinal X, Angie Wong. The movie is now playing in festivals. Please find it if you can. And I look forward to release hopefully later this year. You can always find them on Twitter and Instagram at Cardinal X Movie. They're also on Facebook. Look them up. It's at Cardinal X Movie.
Once again, thank you for listening to the Hollywood Outsider Podcast. We try to bring you interviews with filmmakers in the world of independent cinema whenever we can. So I really hope you enjoyed this one. Angie was really great to talk to. Go check out her movie, Cardinal X. It's really good. Remember to subscribe and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice, or our podcast app, whatever you do. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com, as well as all those other things that I already mentioned. Now, this is Aaron Peterson reminding you that the next time you head into the theater to see Cardinal X, buy popcorn. We'll be right back.